Did this record bring any interest from the Heilitzers?
No, but it did from Roulette, and I sold it to Roulette for $1,000 and a round trip ticket to New York. Roulette was heading south at that point in time, so I felt lucky to get the money, and I felt lucky to get the guy's exposure on a national label.
How did Roulette come to know about this Minneapolis record?
I don't know, but I got the call from there, and I can't remember the name of the guy. He's the nicest can be.
Morris Levy?
He was the head of it. Their head promotion guy. I can't think of his name. He's just a wonderful man.
So they put out the exact same two songs.
Yeah,
Hey exactly. Joe and Sunny Day. Did the record get national airplay then?
I think it got somewhere low on the Billboard Hot 100. Might have made 96 or something. If I don't know, Phil, maybe you know more about it than me.
I think the Bubbling Under. I know for sure we probably made that. And that's not what that one is, Tom. But it was one of those type of programs, though. If I can add to what it did do is we had maybe four or five national markets, which created jobs and travel for us and exposure. But they were widespread. There was somewhere in Florida, Lincoln, Nebraska, we were huge. Tucson, we got airplay, and other places, but those are three pretty good markets.
Yeah.
And we ended up to take advantage of those, other than we didn't go to Florida. But did
Roulette ever express an interest in doing an album by the Steel Rovers?
No, I think had they had more success, they would have, but they didn't.
Okay.
They never did to me, at least.
Okay, then we move on to the next 45. By the Steel Rovers, and that's Little Picture Playhouse, backed with Cast Thy Burden Upon the Stone. This Little Picture Playhouse has quite an interesting story. I know Phil has talked about it before, but it's worth mentioning again how this record came to the.
It was Dave who had a lot of.
Yeah, Dave Dean was one of the original members of the Steel Rovers, as was I, and his brother was a smart high school student and got a chance to go study in England, and I can't remember exactly the dates or how long he was there, but it may have been a summer, and he came back with several albums, of which one was Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, and this was a cut from that, and I don't know if it was a single in England or not, but we picked up on it, and Dave liked it because Dave's a keyboard player, so he was always looking for songs that had
keyboard
something to feature him.
The keyboard,
right. Mm-hmm. We had a version of it, and we had just got a new singer in the band who had a real crisp voice and fit the song real well. And the recording session went well, and we got some airplay again. It wasn't as successful as Hey Joe, but
no.
Kept our name out there, and
yeah.
it was a pretty good record.
Now, this came out on the August label. Did you create that name as well, Peter?
Well, like I said, I clipped it out of a magazine I think it was a Columbia or Capitol record ad, hyping the new releases for August. And I just took the word August out of the headline of this ad, and
cut and
stole
paste.
It. I just stole the artwork is what it boils down to.
Now, you're a dub for this one, as well as the prior one, Hey Joe and Sunny Day. Well, what do you recall about dub recording?
Well, I recall Arv.
The engineer?
Yeah. The poor guy was getting stiffed right and left by every band in town. They'd go in and record and say, Jesus, Arv, we're so short right now. We just can't give you the 250 or whatever. And Arv would say, okay. And he'd write it down in the book, you know. It was actually it was a pretty nice place. And it had a four-track, which at the time was pretty hot. If you were pretty good, like Warren Kendrick recorded there, who was a pretty good producer. You could get good sound out of it. If you're a dumb bleeper like me, you get nothing out of it except pure nothing, you know. I mean, I just was horrible as a producer. Even at the time, I was deaf in one ear, so I'm still winging it. Yeah, and I should have been more forthcoming with my inability to do this stuff correctly.
Well, but nevertheless, Little Picture Playhouse is played in the Twin Cities market.
Yes, yeah, slightly, yeah.
Now, at this point, do you start managing the Steel Rovers as well?
Yeah, probably. I'm not sure whether at that point in time, Stagefinders might have fallen apart as a booking agency. Roslansky might have said, I can't make any money at this thing. Or the guy that basically owned Stagefinders provided rent and stuff like that, said, you know, this ain't working, or I sold the building, or, you know, whatever it was. But I think we had to open up some new channels and some new booking channels. I was not going to go to Shapiro and Bill Deal. That's a cinch. And I hooked him up with, any old booker that would take him, and a guy down in Kansas.
James Reardon.
His whole deal was to get songs played on Coma in Oklahoma. And you guys remember KOMA in Oklahoma City at night. And 1520, I think it was, on the dial. God, what a boomer.
That could be heard in Minnesota at night,
absolutely,
right?
Yeah. But boy, if you got down into Kansas and Nebraska and Oklahoma and Colorado and Utah, you know, you really could hear it. And so Reardon, that's all he really wanted, was to get a band that got some tunes on Coma in Oklahoma City. He was a sharp guy. You know, he was a real sharp guy. He'd steal from you if he could, and that's the way it is.
So was he able to get the Steel Roving on KOMA?
No. As far as I know, he wasn't. Maybe he wasn't.
No, we never got airplay. We got a lot of jobs, though, and we actually ended up relocating down to that area for a while in
Denver.
Yeah, I mean, if he was in... he was also a promoter. I mean, he was a booker and a promoter. So, you know, he'd say, Steel Roving will be in Enid, Oklahoma, and it was on Coma. So... Mm-hmm. That kind of self-generated the interest in the band.
Did you go on the road with the band, Peter?
Sometimes.
How did you like going on the road?
I don't know.
How about the F-85? Want to tell them about the F-85?
Yeah, let's hear about the F-85.
I don't know.
What is the F-85? Oh,
it was an old Oldsmobile station wagon that Peter had.
Oh, God.
And I think we were driving from Denver to somewhere in Nebraska, and it was in the middle of winter. The heat went out in the car. So for about 50, 80 miles, we're freezing our butts off in this car. We limp into Julesburg, Colorado, to have a radiator guy look at it and fix it up for us. So we're sitting around there in Julesburg for 4 hours, eating at restaurants and whatever. Yeah. But that's the one thing I remember about Pete's automobiles.
nice car.
I also had a green Ford station wagon. Of course, you had to have station wagons. You're carrying all these knuckleheads, and yeah, they burned it up. I think Dave Dean was driving, and he said, you can see the steel coming out the tailpipe and bouncing down the interstate. And I'm saying, Dave, don't you think there might have been a small problem with the car? Well, I don't know. It got him to the gig. Can you guys remember that, where that green Ford wagon burned up?
It
burned up.
Huh? Oh, yeah, God. I mean, they could see the motor going out the tailpipe. Holy smokes. It was like charcoal briquettes going on.
That doesn't sound like a good thing for a car.
It was about a $50 cash-in by the time. Bring your title, bro. You know, we'll give you $50 for it.
Did you have to... Did you have to rent a trailer to pull behind the vehicle?
No, these guys, the Steel Roving, actually had good vans. They invested in the Ford, what was it? The
Econoline.
Econoline, yeah, and they were new, and they crashed them up just with great regularity and put them in the ditch and did all the stuff, but at least I wasn't involved in it.
So. That would hold everything.
Yeah.
But were you able to get the whole band and all the equipment into your station wagon?
No. They put all the equipment in the Ford van. Had I did the road?
Van
the
and Arab were the two roadies.
Yeah, we yeah.
Van and Arab.
Van.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Remember Van Lundin?
Van
maybe?
Lundin.
Yeah.
And who's Arab?
Arab. That was his nickname, but can't remember his real name.
I'll think of it here in a minute.
Yeah.
He was one of those guys with, I think, one prominent tooth. You know,
as I'm missing a tooth.
Well, you know, roadies of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s were carny workers of the 10s, 20s, and 30s.
Yeah,
you know, right. It's the same deal.
That's a good way to put it.
So how did the Steel Roving do out of town compared to the Twin Cities where you were well known?
I think personally, and I'm going to let Phil speak, but I think personally they did pretty damn well in the Twin Cities. Most of the time I wasn't out of town. Okay. You know, and I would also say that in the area surrounding the Twin Cities, down to southern Minnesota along the Iowa border, you know, north of St. Cloud and stuff, they did very well. And you were talking ballrooms, and they'd pack the hell out of them. So,
but how about when you went to, like, Enid, Oklahoma?
Yeah, for that period, Pete was still our manager, but we were booking through Reardon and Associates out of Hayes. So we were staying in hotels all the time. That's before we actually got a place in Denver and stayed there for about 6 months. But we were just on the road, and at some point we were still coming back until we left for kind of a long period of time. For about a year, we were gone most of a year at one point. But Pete was still the manager, and the gigs were great because people knew us down there, and we were playing some just regular bars and play in high schools and things like that. We had some real nice jobs with the Turtles and with Steppenwolf and
nice. Steppenwolf in Wichita
and
Turtles in Salina
and in Tucson. We played with Buffalo Springfield and
still a great band. And, yeah, they were good and good in person. Wow.
And they had the Starland Vocal Band and Brenton Wood. Just Give Me a Little Sign, Girl.
Yeah.
So we were part of that show anyway. We had some great, great opportunities.
So then we're on to your next 45s. The first one of these last two is also on the August label. Come in the Morning, backed with Necessary Person.
Come in the Morning was Moby Grape. And Necessary Person, I think, was an original written by Michael O'Gara.
And how did that song do, Peter?
Nothing. They sold nothing. Zero. Okay. You know, I might have put out, at that point, I had enough money that I was able to probably print 2,000 and cover every radio station with at least two copies that was within the Midwest. And I limited myself to New Orleans Louisiana North, just coming back up to the Twin Cities, because that's all you could afford, and it even then it was kind of expensive packaging and mailing these dang things, and you know, buying these mailer envelopes and you know, getting the labels put on and making it look professional and making it look like you were something was really part of the deal. But you know, you think about back in the day, it was so damned easy to put together a record company, per se. I mean, it just took nothing. I mean, you could do it right out of your hip pocket or on credit cards, as opposed to this beautiful job you guys have done. So,
where did we record Come in the Morning? Was it? I know we did something in Clovis, New Mexico. It was like Get Ready and some other cover tunes, but where did Come in the Morning?
I think we recorded that one there, too.
At Clovis.
Yeah, at
Norman Petty's
studio. What's the name of that studio?
Yeah, where he did Buddy Holly. Or,
yeah, it was a Buddy Holly studio, yeah. I wasn't involved in that.
Nowhere.
That was Reardon's deal, so it was not me. Yeah.
And was Necessary Person also recorded there?
I have no idea.
I'm a little vague on exactly where that was.
Phil, do you have any memory?
You know, I think it was. We did. I know we did a version of Get Ready
several
there,
numbers.
Which actually was kind of a fun one to do. But we must have done. Gosh, these are tough questions.
We
did like three or four songs there, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then now that record was out for a while, and then you decided to make a switch on the A side to Have You Ever Seen Me. How did that switch come about, Peter?
I was probably really pissed, you want to know the truth of the matter, that they would have gone down to another studio without talking to me, and I was pissed at Reardon. But that's the only thing I can think of at this point in time. It was obvious that the O'Gara song wasn't going anywhere.
So you,
those are the only explanations I can give you, because I can't remember.
So you weren't happy that the songs weren't getting airplay, and you wanted to try a different song.
Exactly. Exactly, and I had a B-side that was doing nothing anyway, so put it on.
So Have You Ever Seen Me, where does this song come from, Dave?
You know, I was just thinking of that, and I honestly, it's a cover tune for
Small Faces.
Small Faces, that's right.
Yeah, yep. Yeah.
So that was the Small Faces from England, correct?
Right, and that was Dave Dean wanted that and thought it would do well. In fact, we should have been, even with my lousy production skills, should have been doing much more dance music. We were, you know, as a band doing a lot of artsy fartsy stuff that A isn't going to sell too much, and B isn't going to, at the time, having a good danceable tune was really important.
Right. So Have You Ever Seen Me, did that get any airplay at all or not?
Yeah, I got a little. Got a little outstate, yeah.
So it did better than Come in the Morning?
Yes. Yeah, Come in the Morning, if it sold one copy, I don't know who bought it, unless it was the guy that sang it.
So where did you press your records at?
At K-Bank Studios up north Minneapolis, I think.
Okay.
I mean, I know it was up north Minneapolis, but I don't know exactly where.
Did you ever go to the pressing plant and watch the process?
Oh, sure, sure.
Can you walk us through a little bit how that worked?
Well, you'd take your acetates, which were the master acetates, and they would coat them with gold or silver. I can't remember whether it was gold or silver. And that became the A side would be the mother, and the B side would become the stamper. And they had literally hot vinyl, and they had these two things set up, and you'd get a blob on the mother side, and then they would be put together like a waffle iron, and there was quite a bit of heat behind it. Oh, yeah, and let me see, I'm trying to think of how they got the label in there. Maybe you can help me on that.
Well, that must have come after they pressed the vinyl together.
No, it was all them. Once they put the label down, they put the blob.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. Yeah, it. Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Then it turned the outside.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
So
yeah.
So the label went on top of the blob of hot vinyl.
No, one on the bottom. The label went in first. Blob of hot vinyl. Another label. Squish.
Yep.
And so, and then they would trim the excess. And I can't remember whether that was automated, because K-Bank at the time was even then was not a very advanced pressing plant, but it was really nice to have. And they, you know, their stuff was adequate. Money Music was pressed there, and almost everything I did except the one with O'Gara.
I'm glad you brought up Money Music, because this has become one of the most sought after albums to ever come out of Minnesota.
And why, I don't know, but what the heck. In all these bands, I just called them and said, you got something? I'm throwing this album together, and I'll try and give you, you know, 10 cents a play or whatever the heck it was. And I'm not sure whether I sent them a letter, you know, stating what I would do. It sold about what I pressed.
Which was how many?
I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000. But now all of a sudden you're talking some real money pressing those things. And remember, I'm trying to raise a family. I'm not making much money. You know, I got a mortgage. I got kids.
I'm
switching jobs every 20 minutes. Drinking heavily. No, I'm just kidding.
Thank God some things don't change, huh?
How did you come up with this name, Money Music?
Well, the only thing I had for artwork, once again, I was short on artwork. I did have that Confederate Five. And I got that at an antique store, and I'm trying to think of where the hell I got that. But I bought it either in, remember when Lake Street, Minneapolis, used to have a lot of antique stores? And this would be back in the 60s and 70s. I bought it down on East Lake Street, I'm pretty sure. They had a music store, and I had a hundreds, and I had some ones. But that one was the only one that I framed up, because it was the only one that was any good. That wasn't just, you know, completely folded and pocket wrinkled and, you know. And so I thought, well, what the heck? This is all Confederate hits, so why not, you know, I mean, it's all kind of phony baloney. Let's put it together.
What do you mean?
There isn't one song on there that, you know, busted anybody's doors open. And I got to give a shout out right now to the CA Quintet. God, they were a good outfit. They were really, really, really a righteous little band. I mean, by the way, when I was at Stage Finders, I worked with, who's the guy that did the grind?
Gregory Dean the
Ivanis. Oh, I worked with Gregory Dean. What a good man. He was kind of at the end of it at that point in time. I think would really put together
something. Just for the record, Dave, why don't you read off the names of the artists and the songs on the Money Music album?
All right. Side one, of course, starts with Hey Joe, the Still Rovin', and then Mickey's Monkey, the CA Quintet, Sweetest Girl in the World by the Underbeats. I barely remember that one. Faces by TC Atlantic. Heat Wave by the Hot Half Dozen. Flight Reaction by the Calico Wall. Side two then, Feel So Fine, the Castaways. Blow to My Soul, the CA Quintet. Dirty Old Man, the Electras. Without Love by the Seraphic Street Sound. Cool Breeze by the HT3 and Hydrogen Atom by the Bedlam 4.